are here, and I'm your host, Brian Beatty. Welcome to the podcast, Volume 2, Edition 1. Or, if you are keeping count in a less pretentious, less literary way, the 13th edition of the podcast. Which very quickly brings us to this month's theme, Lucky 13. Because I consider myself lucky to get to sit down recently with traditional musician, singer-songwriter, Duluthian, Charlie Parr. We got together in Dinkytown at the podium to talk about songwriting. And he offered, after the interview, to let me feature a song from his forthcoming album, Barn Swallow. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get to the good stuff. You told NPR in an interview last year, I think in October or November, that you started playing guitar at 7, and we're about writing. So I'm wondering, when did you actually start writing your own songs?
That wasn't until after my dad died in 1995. Because I started when I was 7, I started trying to play the guitar, but I was listening to my dad's old blues records and folk records and trying to play, you know, those songs. Never even thought about writing, you know, songs. And when I was, you know, late teens and early 20s, I'd occasionally write short stories just to kind of, you know, because I'd have ideas and write them down. It was horrible short story writing. I was really bad at it. And every once in a while, I had a friend of mine who was a pretty good writer, and I'd send him stuff. And he'd read it, and he's like, oh, you know, you've got a little glimpses here and there. But he said, it's horrible. Get a job, you know, just stop it. And so I'd you know, take advice and put all these stories in the back of my mind. And then when my dad died, I had a really, really hard time with it. You know, I couldn't grieve. It was, you know, the kind of sadness that's just, you know, really frightening for me because it was so deep and big. And then I wrote a couple of songs, and basically the songs that I wrote initially on 1922 and Ode to a New Dealer were kind of songs that had to do with things that my dad had said, you know, stories that he told me. He had a kind of a wild life, you know, before he got married and settled down. He had all kinds of stories about it that he'd sit and tell you. And so I wrote songs to try to remember, you know, what he said. They weren't, you know, anything I was particularly thrilled with, but there they were. And then after I did that, then I wanted to keep going, and I wrote more. And now it's almost like an addiction, but it's now it's a habit, I guess.
Okay. So was your dad a writer?
Yeah, he was a storyteller. Okay. Not even on purpose, you know. He was a digressor.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't the kind of storyteller that, you know, you're always going to tell us a story now. He's the kind of guy that he would never say hardly anything. He was a man of very few words. And then he'd start talking, and if I asked him a question about something, he would usually, you know, go over here and turn into this great long story and then come back over to answering my question. You know, that's the kind of storyteller he was. And that's kind of the kind of storyteller I'm turning out to be, you know, that I don't have a set kind of mode. If I set off to say one thing, I'll end up, you know, with an attachment that'll end up being a decent story.
So how does that digressive storytelling style evolve into a songwriting structure where you typically have to be a little more concise and focused? Unless you're Bob Dylan circa 1965.
Yeah. I'm not really sure. You know, what the process right now is that, you know, ideas come up and I kind of hear in my head what, you know, what the song would kind of, what kind of road the song would take, you know, if I was going to tell that story with the song, you know. And then, you know, it just kind of starts showing up. I'm not really sure how it gets distilled, you know, other than just me, you know, brooding over it. And then, you know, as it starts to come out, you know, in kind of an alive way, you know, I boil it down playing it, you know. Because, I mean, songs get written, for me, songs get written, and they're like 30 verses long sometimes. And then they get boiled down in the playing, you know, and I'll sit and play them and think, well, that's, you know, just completely, you know, redundant verses, you know, and then boil everything down. And lately they've been getting a little too short. The new songs that I've been writing lately are a little longer again.
Okay.
But you know, it's kind of.
So you started playing guitar in the 70s, started writing songs in 95. Obviously, you played a lot in there in the meantime, a lot of country blues, country influence. Did you have songwriters, once you did start writing songs in 1995, that, okay, now I'm going to write these songs for my dad?
Right.
Did you look for influences then in terms of like the music you've been playing, or did you go out and look for songwriting influences? Because a lot of those country blues guys, they got by for years rehashing the same 15 verses or the same three tropes and ideas. I mean, in Mississippi, John Hurt, a songster, you know, had a stockpile of songs, but within those songs, probably 75 of them had similar verses or choruses.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, because the songwriters that I'm, you know, the most kind of influenced by are really more guitar players first for me, you know. And there's songs that they wrote, like, well, Booker White and Robert Pete Williams, John Lee Hooker records, especially the early stuff, you know, almost like they were making it up as they went along, you know, just, oh, I'm going to make up a song about the assassination of President Lincoln, you know, and there it went. And I was really influenced by that, but I don't have that skill, you know, of just making up a song on the spur of the moment. The you know, I was obviously, you know, there's a lot of my sister, like Bob Dylan. It was Bob Dylan around, and I still love Bob Dylan. You know, it's hard to not. I love writers like Towns Van Zandt. He's a lot more introspective than I tend to be, you know, as far as the way I don't really approach songwriting as having anything to do with me, you know.
Do you think that's because you started out trying to articulate your dad's tales?
I think so.
And recount those?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of kind of vintage history in your songs that you're obviously too young to have lived and experienced.
Right, right. Oh, exactly. I mean, and, you know, the other kind of, you know, songwriter that I've probably been influenced by the most is Greg Brown. You know, especially like the Over and Under kind of thing, where he seems to be, you know, reaching out towards almost like Raymond Carver style vignettes and mm-hmm. presenting them in a song. You know, I like that kind of stuff. John Hyatt too, you know. Okay.
Well, you mentioned Carver, who's obviously a literary short story writer and poet. Are there writers that you read or have taken inspiration from, whether fiction or poetry? Or?
Well, for sure, Carver, Flannery O'Connor, Steinbeck, Faulkner. Those were the guys that I was the most taken with when I dropped out of high school. And when I dropped out of high school, it's funny because I read all the time when I was a kid. I read constantly. And my friends and I would read. If I wasn't playing music, I was reading. You know, I wasn't a sporty kid, you know. Rode my bike, played the guitar, and read. That's all I did. When I dropped out of high school, I dropped out because I was so uninterested in having to deal with kind of that bad social atmosphere of high school. It wasn't because I was not able to keep up, you know. But I just wanted to sit at home in the basement and play the guitar and read. And so I dropped out of high school, but when I dropped out, I was, you know, I was reading, you know, Steinbeck, and I was reading a lot of the beat writers too, you know. And that's the stuff that I feel kind of the closest to when I read, and that's the stuff that ends up, especially Carver, the way he had, you know, this ability to like distill some kind of, you know, these images that you can't get out of your head into a little story, you know, the kids cutting that fish in half. I never ever get that image out of my head now, you know, and it's just amazing. It's just a few words and bam, there it is. It's stuck inside your head forever.
I wonder, do you see an evolution in your songwriting process from those early songs to now, and how would you describe that, and what do you think's influenced that?
I see the thing is, now I've got a clearer idea of what I want from the get-go, because before it was I viewed it as just being a gift from God, you know. It was just, oh, here's a song, it's great. Now I've got a story in mind, you know. I've got kind of the feeling of it, and then I you know, spend a lot of time fussing around with the way the music and the words fit together. And then,
you start with words first and then put the music to it, or?
No, I kind of start with the idea of what I want the song to be about.
Like the theme.
The theme. And then, you know, sometimes I don't have any, like, idea about the lyrics at all. The music and the atmosphere that the music creates will come long before the lyrics do, you know, because I know I've got this idea, you know, how I want the music to sound, where I want it to go, you know. And I'm not a trained guitar player, so I can't sit down and decide what I want to do on paper. I have to sit with the guitar and play because I have no idea what I'm doing. I never took any lessons. I don't know what to call what it is that I play. And then the song is never done. I mean, the song that I wrote earliest on in the 90s, you know, I still don't regard them as being finished. I'll play certain shows where I'll pull out a song that I haven't played in a long time and have a new idea about what I want the atmosphere of the song to be like. So it's not really
musically and lyrically, or mm-hmm. just
okay. Oh yeah, I've changed stuff up a lot, you know, and that's what's kind of unfair about, you know, recording, because, you know, what you've recorded is the way that song happened to have been at that on that day,
right,
that you did it, and it's not done, never really done.
Sure. A lot of the songs you've written kind of would be considered to fall in the gospel music category. But I wonder, is there anything compelling, particularly compelling to you about those religious themes? Do they kind of present limitations, opportunities, challenges? Because you have such a range of subject matter, but lately it seems like you bring more of a gospel inflection to them.
Well, man, I love the gospel music of kind of the turn of the last century. Gospel music, you know, and we've been lucky because they've started re-releasing a lot of that stuff that we haven't really had an opportunity to hear. When I grew up, I didn't go to church. There was a before I was like five, there was a Methodist church my mother would take us to once in a while. My dad decided that he had didn't really enjoy that very much. But you know, every weekend, my mom and dad worked at the packing house. They were both meat packers. And I'm not sure what it was, but every weekend, every Friday, you know, they'd work like 12-hour days. Every Friday night, come home and Dad would like have the gear, the fishing poles, the tents, and the truck. We were going to go camping for the weekend. Every weekend, so church just was not, you know, Sunday morning was not for churching. It was for fishing, you know, in the summertime. And I, you know, from an early age, I kind of equated my dad's sense of faith, which was, you know, almost like Wittgenstein in a way, you know, that which you cannot say anything about, it's best to keep silent about. You know, you show your religiosity in the way you live your life, not in what you say. And that's the way he was. You know, he never talked about that stuff. You know, you talked about, you know, stuff you can talk about, not religion, not politics. And so now when I think about songs, that's the way I can kind of express, you know, the weird kind of faith that I have without saying anything about it. You know, I mean, religion is pretty frightening, and I don't go to church, and I don't, you know, profess any particular religion. I know I have a faith. I can't put my finger on what it is. It comes out in the music, you know.
You mentioned that your folks were meat packers. You've written, in addition to religious songs and kind of traditional blues songs, you've written what might be called labor songs as well. Does that come out of growing up the son of meat packers in Austin, Minnesota?
Definitely. I mean, I'm super heavily influenced by the way I grew up, and I'm still influenced by it, kind of the swirl of that kind of life. Because I go home, and my mom's still doing pretty good. She's going to be 85 this year. She's living in Austin. And we have these conversations all the time because her mind is sharp, and she, you know, now that the union has started to be kind of an endangered species in this country, you know, she's got a very, very much concerned about that, and she watches the news, you know. And I was raised up in a family where, you know, the union was a big deal,
right,
you know, and yeah, it influenced me a lot. And I tried to write about the strike in Austin in the 90s, you know. And I did write a song that was very specifically about the strike that my mother just absolutely despises. And I think I understand why, because it's very much too personal, and, and I'm not part of the rank and file, you know, and she's old school, you know, you're not.
You didn't pay your dues.
You didn't pay your dues. You don't have any kind of call to sing about this, you know. And she's right.
She's right.
This strike in the 90s, if you really dig into the history of it, there was a real battle internally in the union between kind of the old guard, the old rank and file, and a new thing happening in the union, a less malleable member, you know, coming up. And they called the old guard P-10ers because they wanted to sit down and figure this out. And what's wrong? Why can't we get back to work? And the younger people, oh, let's strike, let's get John Cougar Mellencamp to come to town and the Communist Party to help us march and let's paint murals, you know. And the older guy said, let's talk and figure this out. There's got to be a way to get back to work, you know. And my folks were the older part. They were older. You know, my dad had already retired when the strike came up. And my mom was on her way to retiring. You know, they were older than the folks there. So, but yeah, their views on labor and unions are basically my views.
So on the new album, I've sensed another kind of evolution in the songwriting, in the sense that unlike the traditional blues that got by with these kind of rhyming couplets that worked in song after song, you seem to be like foregoing kind of the end rhyme lines a little more maybe than usual, and kind of this lyrical structure of traditional songs seems to be opening up a little bit, maybe not specifically on Barn Swallow, but it seemed like I noticed it more on Barn Swallow. Was that a conscious thing?
I think it is a conscious thing. I think the thing for me has been lately that the story has become kind of more important than the structure of the song, you know? And so if a chorus happens to be appropriate or seems to fit in, then fine. A lot of the songs have choruses, but if it doesn't, then even better. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I'm a big fan of the sound at the end of a phrase, you know, and the sound at the end of the next phrase, rather than rhyming that they had, there's a name for that. But you know, they're related in a different way than just a rhyme, you know. And I'm not that good at rhymes, because then I find myself like searching around for words that maybe start leading me away from
your story.
The story, you know. So I thought, well, I really did kind of get back to I'm going to write a story. I'm going to basically set it to a music, or, you know, create kind of a musical atmosphere around the story, you know. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, the most kind of glaring example of it is Badger, which is just, you know, is actually probably just a better story than it is a song. The music and the words don't really have much of a relationship, but atmospheric, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to say anything about the song we're going to share with listeners, which is Jesus is a Hobo, unless there is something you think listeners might want to know about that song that the song doesn't give them itself.
I don't know where that song came from, to be honest with you. I was having a conversation with Joe Tatey, who also wrote the liner notes of the record, down in Winona, and we were talking about, you know, my favorite topic is philosophy. He's a philosophy professor, and I'm a failed philosophy student. And we're talking about Kierkegaard at one point. Some of Kierkegaard's writings talking about, you know, the Messiah would return again, and no one would know it was him. And that's some kind of a slip of his clothing, and you'd see, you know, the royal robes underneath his clothes, you know. That's kind of what it's basically about, but it's also about, you know, I worked in homeless camps for many, many years and met so many folks who are just, you know, the kindest, most generous, kind of most real people, you know, kept you right in the moment, you know, talking to these guys, honest and you know, just I'm really grateful for every conversation I had with these fellas. Most of them were train riders, you know, or had been, and now they're too old or maybe have some other health problems. They don't ride trains anymore. But, you know, I guess I thought about those guys and about how, you know, in a world where I don't really feel like, you know, we're talking about political guys, you know, the rich folks, you know, I don't feel like you can trust those guys. And it's sad, and bad kind of irony is that they have the power and you feel like you can't trust them. The guys that I feel like I have always been able to trust have been those other guys, you know, who, you know, maybe living outside or very poor or riding freight trains and stuff like that, you know. And if the story of Christ is true, you know, he's not going to come back hanging out with Mitt Romney. He's going to seek out the most sincere members of the population. I feel lucky to have met some of those guys that I felt were just the most sincere people I've ever met. And that's who the song is kind of for, I guess.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for talking to us, and I hope listeners enjoy the song, Jesus is a Hobo.
Jesus is a hobo on a fast freight out of Denver, huddled up on the twin stack, his back against the rain. He's hoping to make the West Coast, his food is running low. He's been traveling on these roads for 2,000 years or more. You're gonna need me. You're gonna need me. Can you find me where you look? You're gonna need me. You're gonna need me. You can't always see the truth. Jesus is a hobo in a jungle near L.A., where nobody really knows him, even if they know his face. They stare into his eyes, a disciple from the past. But the moment's gone and lost, and the engine's long, low whine. Jesus is a hobo, he never left us here. Caught a fast one from Calvary, and he's been riding ever since. You're gonna need me. You're gonna need me. But can you find me? You're gonna need me. You're gonna need me. You can't always see the truth. Jesus is a hobo riding south out of St. Paul, seeing a cathedral through the snowflakes and bracing against the cold. gets down to Rock Island, maybe there he'll let them know that underneath his coveralls he wears a purple robe. You're gonna need me, you're all gonna need me, and you find me where you look. You're gonna need me, you're all gonna need me, you can't always hobo on a fast break out of Denver, huddled up under a twin stack, his back against the rain. You're gonna need me, you're gonna need me, but can you find me? You're gonna need me, you're gonna need me, you can't always see the truth.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Charlie and his new song. His new album, Barn Swallow, is officially released in February, but you can order CDs directly from his website right now. I'd like to thank the guys also at the podium who were trying out new guitars in the rehearsal room next to where Charlie and I recorded for keeping the atmosphere real. And don't forget, because I almost did, that you can find us anytime at mnartist.org, on Facebook, and iTunes. You Are Here is a monthly literary podcast production of mnartist.org. mnartist.org is a joint project of the Walker Art Center and the McKnight Foundation. The mission of mnartist.org is to improve the lives of Minnesota artists and provide access to and engagement with Minnesota's arts.